Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is Who Protects the Worker, Volume 8 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Unions and government both try to protect workers, but it usually comes at the expense of other workers. Both end up restricting freedom. Milton Friedman explains how the competition of employers for the talents of workers leads to the highest wages and best working conditions. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
People who earn their living in a modern heavy industry seldom engage in the kind of backbreaking toil that was the everyday lot of most workers a century ago. And yet, they earn far more. What has produced these improvements?
The offhand reaction of most people is likely to be that labor unions are largely responsible for the enormous progress that workers have made in the past two centuries. But clearly, at least for the United States, that cannot be true. After all, in the 19th century, when workers did very well, there were hardly any labor unions at all. And even today, no more than one out of four or five workers is a member of a trade union. And the remainder do very well indeed, achieving the highest level of living in the world. Labor unions do, of course, benefit their members, but far from being a key to the development of the modern society, they are a throwback to an earlier pre-industrial era, to the agreements among craftsmen in the Middle Ages, or to go back even earlier, more than 2,000 years ago, to the agreement among medical men in Greece.
From the tiny Greek island of Kos, the coast of Asia Minor is 4 miles away in the mist. 2,500 years ago, a hospital and medical school flourished on Kos. The great Hippocrates, the founder of modern medicine, worked there. Legend has it that Hippocrates taught his students in the shade of this plane tree. He welcomed anyone who wanted to learn, so long as they paid his fees. There's another legend that St. Paul stood here and preached the gospel of Christianity. What isn't legend is that Hippocrates and his followers started medicine on the road forward to becoming a science. When Hippocrates died at the age of 104, or so legend has it, this island was full of medical people, his students and disciples. Competition for custom was fierce. Some 20 years after he died, they got together and constructed a code of conduct. They named it the Hippocratic Oath, after their old teacher and master. Every new physician, before he could start practice, came to this spot back here in front of those columns and took the oath. The oath was full of fine ideals for protecting the patient, but it also had a couple of other things in it. Listen to this one. I will impart a knowledge of the art to my own sons and those of my teachers and to disciples bound by a stipulation and oath according to the law of medicine, but to none others. Today we'd call that a closed shop. Or listen to this one, referring to patients suffering from the agonizing disease of kidney or bladder stones. I will not cut persons laboring under the stone, but will leave this to be done by men who are practitioners of this work. A nice market-sharing agreement between physicians and surgeons. Hippocrates must turn in his grave when a new class of medical men takes that oath. After all, he taught anyone, provided only they paid his tuition. He would strongly have objected to the kind of restrictive practices that physicians all over the world have adopted to protect their custom. In the United States, the American Medical Association has for decades been one of the strongest labor unions in the country, keeping down the number of physicians, keeping up the costs of medical care, preventing competition by people from outside the profession with those in it. All, of course, in the name of helping the patient.
Hey, it up?
I don't know.
I've got a support right here.
Without warning, any one of us may suddenly need medical care. If we do, we want the very best care we can get. But who can give us that care? Is it always a graduate of an expensive medical school who has a union card called a medical license? Or might it be someone like this, a trained paramedic working for a private enterprise organization rendering emergency care?
And hopefully we'll get a very good contract out of that.
Many such businesses provide primary care for emergency cases in the United States. This particular paramedic team is attached to a fire department in Southern California. They're good at their job, but it's not unusual to find local physicians objecting.
They take the Hippocratic Oath here in the United States, and they believe that they should be the one that is treating their patient. They should be the one that saves that patient's life. And if someone else does it, it just kind of interferes with everything that they've been taught.
But why should medical care be a monopoly of licensed physicians? Shouldn't anyone who is capable of providing effective help be free to do so?
Let me take your blood pressure here.
Does anyone see him go down?
Yeah, he was just laying here when we got here.
You can be sure that no one will be able to stay in this business very long unless he can demonstrate by performance that he's doing a good job. Joe Dolphin knows that very well.
We've taken some statistical samples of the kind of effectiveness paramedics have in California. I'll give you an example that in one district of California that we serve, which is a county, which is populated to the extent of 580,000 people, before the introduction of paramedics, less than 1% of the patients that suffered a cardiac arrest where their heart stopped lived through their hospital stay and were released from the hospital. With the introduction of paramedics, just in the first 6 months of operation, 23% of the people whose heart stops are successfully resuscitated and are released from the hospital and go back to productive work in society. We think that's pretty amazing. We think the facts speak for themselves. However, relating that to the medical community is sometimes very difficult. They have ideas of their own.
Respiration's 12 and regular.
Right.
All right, looks good to me, Dave.
Okay, Scripps, how are you reading this down there? Okay, you guys ready to go?
Yeah.
Scripps says code 2. Code 2.
Disputes between union and non-union workers are not always as high-minded as between organized medicine and Joe Dolphin. One day in 1978, workers at a coal loading dock on the Ohio River in southern Indiana continued to work after the Mine Workers Union had called a strike. That night, a crowd of armed union men invaded the site.
And then they fired a little building setting here after they fired Mr. T. Garden's car here and threw another firebomb into the trailer. Others had run on back and were firing trucks and shooting holes through tires with handguns. I'd gone back beyond the loading dock here, was standing back in there, and could hear them shooting and the air escaping from truck tires. Of course, there were so many people moving around and doing so much damage and setting so many things on fire, a whole lot of things going on at one time. We should have been heavily armed and shot these people, did something to stop such destruction. I wouldn't have believed that a rabble-rouser could have gathered together that many irresponsible people to come onto a person's property and do this kind of destruction until I'd finally seen it done.
These workers are on the other side of the union fence. They're building two Social Security offices in Baltimore. On this government project, everyone's a union worker. They rely on their union to protect them against competition from non-union labor. But some local contractors see a very different side to a closed shop.
We don't feel that anybody should be denied a choice, and we feel every man should have the choice if he wants to be unionized or not. Not legislative, not saying he must belong to a union. We feel when you tell a man he must belong to a union or he must do this or that, you're taking freedoms away from this man, the freedom of choice of this businessman here to choose me, to do business with me. All business needs this right to choose to do business with each other. And by the same token, our employees have the right to choose whether they want unionization or not.
On this government site, authorized personnel only really means unionized personnel only. Unions have long recognized that the surest and most effective way for them to get power without violence is to have the federal government on their side. That's why so many strong unions have made it a point to locate their headquarters close to the source of power.
The heads of the trade unions that cluster near Capitol Hill know this place very well. It is the room assigned to the Committee on Education and Labor of the House of Representatives, and it is where much of our labor legislation is discussed and shaped before presentation to Congress. I know rooms like this myself very well because I've often testified before congressional committees, and they all meet in rooms like this. Up there on the podium is where the members of the House or of the Senate sit. Of course, behind them there will be clustered a bunch of aides. As you know, there are something like 30 to 40 aides for every single member of the House and the Senate. And very often in one of these committee rooms, there'll be almost nothing but aides around.
When I've sat in the bear pit over here,
where the witnesses sit to testify, I've sometimes thought that maybe the whole thing was a show being conducted by and for the aides, with an occasional member of the House or a senator dropping by to see what the show was all about. This is a room in which hearings were held on the most recent increase in the minimum wage, for example. Who do you suppose testified here in favor of a higher minimum wage rate? Do you suppose it was representatives of the poor people who were supposedly being helped by the bill? Not a bit of it. The major people testifying for it were representatives of the American Federation of Labor, the AFL-CIO, the major organization of trade unions in this country. There's hardly a member of one of their trade unions who works for a wage anywhere close to the minimum wage. Despite all the rhetoric about helping the poor, they were in favor of a higher minimum wage for a very different reason, because it would protect the members of their unions from competition from the lower and lesser skilled people.
To see the effects of minimum wage laws in action, go to a place like this, where they sell quick and inexpensive food. You don't need much training to start work on this job. It used to be a traditional training ground for the unskilled. Not any longer, thanks to the minimum wage laws.
From a worker's point of view, the people that it was supposed to help, the people in some cases it's hurting the most, such as minorities, unskilled labor, and young people. A businessman, especially a small businessman, cannot afford to bring in these people at the higher wage. They are willing, however, to take apprentices and to train them. That's very difficult to do now under the minimum wage laws.
The people who are discriminated against most by a high minimum wage rate are the people with low skills, which includes a disproportionate number of Negroes. Indeed, I have for long believed that the minimum wage rate was a most anti-Negro piece of legislation on our statute books, not by intention, but through its results.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. 205, exactly.
The more they get paid, the better people can live, whether they're paid in cash or in kind. The staff restaurant in the Department of Housing and Urban Development in Washington, D.C. These people are eating subsidized food. Like all civil servants, federal workers get extremely generous fringe benefits. They have also had an incredible degree of security. It's been almost impossible to fire a civil servant. In January 1975, a typist in the Environmental Protection Agency was so consistently late for work that her supervisors demanded she be fired. It took 19 months to do it. And this incredible 21-foot-long chart lists the steps that had to be gone through to satisfy all the rules and all the management and union agreements.
This is really a typical horror story is what it amounts to. And it shows the number of steps you got to go through.
The process involved the girl supervisor, his deputy director, his director, his director of personnel operations, the agency's branch chief, an employee relations specialist, a second employee relations specialist, a special office of investigations, and the director of the office of investigations. This veritable telephone directory, need I add, was paid with taxpayers' money.
Instead of having a system where
who could invent a better protected job than this one before it came to its end?
We now have a time certain at which the decision has to be made within the agency.
Half an hour's drive out of Washington, you come to Montgomery County, where many very senior civil servants live. It has the highest average family income of any county in the United States. Of the people who live here who are employed, one out of every four works for the federal government. Like all civil servants, they have job security, salaries linked to the cost of living, a fine retirement plan, also linked to the cost of living, and many manage to qualify for Social Security as well, becoming double dippers. Many of their neighbors are also here because of the federal government. Congressmen, lobbyists, top executives of corporations with government contracts. As government expands, so does this neighborhood. Government protects its workers just as trade unions protect their members, but both do it at someone else's expense. It doesn't have to be that way. Dick Pashley is an electronics engineer. He designs memory systems for computers. He works for Intel Corporation, one of many companies which have sprung up south of San Francisco in a place that they call Silicon Valley.
All these companies have one thing in common. They're trying to get engineers to work on their projects. You know, myself, I'm one of these engineers, and so obviously I get letters in the mail, phone calls, the like, where people are trying to get me to leave Intel and go to this particular company. One of the companies right across the street here, Intersil, is one of the new companies that's forming in this area, and they're hunting for people just like myself to come in. And what they do is they'll offer you like typically a 30% higher salary, stock options, a bonus, and several other things to get you to move to their company. And since it's not really a move, it's very easy to do because you're only going across the street. It's not a big traumatic thing where you're leaving, let's say, one city and moving to another city. It's very, very straightforward.
In a free labor market, everybody benefits. When the market is restricted, things are very different. Those Mexicans are heading for the United States side of the border. There are real problems about permitting unrestricted immigration into a welfare state. It's one thing when people come for jobs and are on their own, as was the case for most of American history. It's another thing when a welfare system will support them come what may, at the expense of other people. Yet look what happens when you try to interfere with market forces.
Well, there's several fairly large groups of aliens on the hillsides waiting toward the dark to set in. Other groups that are still on the Mexican side of the border, they'll be coming in shortly, I imagine. We have electronic sensors buried in along the hillsides and along the most traveled trails to alert us when there's alien crossings. And from the sensor, we work ahead of them, try to head them off.
No, they're right on the fence. They're just walking east.
Stenforth.
Okay, you got about, I'd say 100 or so here.
Thank you, Foxtrot.
Parate, parate! Parate, parate!
This is not a case of good guys against bad guys. The officers are simply trying to do their duty. The poor Mexicans are driven by hunger and attracted by the prospect of jobs.
You do good work.
The law enforcing people have an impossible job.
They're going to run. They're going to get picked up, sent back, but sooner or later they're going to make it. Time in. 1 minute after the next, you know.
In 1 month in 1978, 60,000 illegal immigrants were arrested on this stretch of the border. But, believe it or not, the Border Patrol estimated that nearly 200,000 found their way through to places like this in Northern California, where there was work waiting for them. Illegal Mexican immigrants are not cheap labor around here. Many earn more than the minimum wage law demands. They can do so because farmers need many extra hands during the harvest season, and there's a shortage of domestic labor available. Jill Hannum and her partner run a farm that produces plump California raisins.
And there's pending legislation which would make it illegal for farmers to hire undocumented workers, and supposedly would impose a $1,000 fine per worker on the farmer. I can't imagine that it would actually go through. If it did, there'd be a full-scale farmer's revolt around here. It's...
Matter of fact, last year, there was quite a bit of activity in the Kerman area, which is about 15 miles west of Fresno. Many of the farmers banded together and as much as warned the Border Patrol to stay off their property. And they were willing to back that up with guns, I'm afraid. They were very upset about it, and because their situation was desperate. They needed the workers, and they needed the work to be done now. And the Border Patrol was interfering with that as they saw it.
Violence by employers to assure the availability of workers is no more justifiable than violence by trade unions to assure their members' jobs. But violence is one of the things you are very likely to get when you try to prevent a deal between people who have jobs to offer and people who are looking for jobs. 15 years ago, the economy of Spartanburg, South Carolina, was stagnant. It depended on peaches and cotton. Wages were lower than the national average, and unemployment was higher than the average. Then, dramatically, the picture changed. The people in Spartanburg decided to make their town a center of free trade. They did this by using a new right-to-work law, eliminating many restrictions on labor. The city council cut taxes to the bone. They advertised the fact that Spartanburg was a place worth investing in. By any standards, let alone Spartanburg's, the result was revolutionary. Industrialists came from Germany, Switzerland, all over the world to build factories to set up plants. The workers of Spartanburg clearly benefited from the new industries. The first to notice were the people who owned and ran the traditional industries.
In terms of the business, it has been a problem for us. It means that we've got to be on our toes. We've got to be sure that we are providing a good workplace, that we are providing good jobs and what have you, and that we are running as competitively as possible. I think that from the workers' point of view, this has certainly provided them with more opportunities to market for their product, their labor, their expertise.
Suddenly, in a free market, workers who once could not find jobs were now at a premium. Everyone benefited, workers and employers alike, and the town thrived. One of the workers who arrived in Spartanburg was Mr. Juma. He came as a refugee from Idi Amin's Uganda.
We came in this country just with $139. I had a family, my wife and two kids. And we came with only 4 bags of clothing, which weighs about 40 pounds each bag. We were not allowed to take more than that. We have to leave all our possession, all our property in the Uganda. And myself, I just came down to Flowers Baking Company, and I was hired as a laborer to work in the plant at $2.49 per hour. Thank
you. 5 years later, he was chief accountant of the company. In a free market, his best protection, his real wealth, turned out to be his skills and his desire to use them.
America has to offer me a lot of things. And this is a great country. I came in this country penniless. Today, I own a house, I own 3 cars. My wife has got a good job. I myself have got a good job. And the children are schooling. And everything has been working so fine. I believe this is because of the opportunity. This is whoever wants to work in this country. There's a lot of opportunity.
When unions get higher wages for their members by restricting entry into an occupation, those higher wages are at the expense of other workers who find their opportunities reduced. When government pays its employees higher wages, those higher wages are at the expense of the taxpayer. But when workers get higher wages and more civilized working conditions through the free market, when they get them by firms competing with one another for the best workers, by workers competing with one another for the best jobs, those higher wages are at nobody's expense. They can only come from higher productivity, greater capital investment, more widely diffused skills. The whole pie is bigger. There's more for the worker, but there's also more for the employer, the investor, the consumer, and even the taxpayer. That's the way a free market system distributes the fruits of economic progress among all the people. That's the essence of the age of the worker.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.